Hello and welcome. Hello and welcome to Morning Energy Live. I'm your host, Andrew Gillick, and today I have the pleasure of sitting down with Kaes Van't Hof, President and CFO of Diamondback Energy, hot off the announcement of one of the biggest deals in the patch this year. Now, what may be surprising to some of you is that Kaes did not grow up in the rich culture of oil and gas business, but on the mean streets of Newport Beach, California, playing tennis and enjoying the surf culture. Did you have frosted tips, Kaes? Don't answer that. Don't answer that. But in his early 20s, he left that all behind, including a young pro tennis career, for the exciting life of finance in New York City. And somehow led him to Midland, Texas. Kaes, welcome to the show.
Yeah, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. All right. So before we get into the details of your business today and where you think we're headed, I got a few questions I want to ask you so the audience can get to know you just a little better. Cool?
Great, great.
All right. I know you're excited for these. All right. So I heard through the grapevine that you may have grown up around the music biz. So I'd like to know, what was the first concert you ever went to?
Yeah, so great. But my uncle's a movie director today. He was a music video director in the early 90s during the heyday of Orange County punk rock. And the first concert I went to was with a band called Sugar Ray. And my uncle's best friend is the lead singer of Sugar Ray. And I went to K-Rock's Almost Acoustic Christmas, which had seven or eight bands. I was in like sixth grade. No Doubt played Hole, Korn, Sugar
Oh my
Ray,
God.
The
I'm just having like
Cardigans. It was
great
great.
flashbacks. That's
90s
fantastic.
flashbacks.
I still want to go to that concert today.
Oh,
That's
it's great. Yeah. K-Rock still hosts it, and a lot of the same bands are still around. So that was my
fantastic.
intro to music.
Couldn't have been better. All right. Next question. Beach or mountains? Now, before you answer, this is a year-round commitment, not seasonal, so think about it hard.
So it's a hard one. Now that I live in Texas, I understand why people go to the mountains in the summer because it's just so hot here. But I'm going to have to go beach. I mean, beach year-round is I've decided I want to be warm in the winter. If I could go to the beach in the winter, I'd be happy.
I appreciate that. We have beach up here in the winter, and the snow on the beach is kind of fun too. I don't know. It's a pretty peaceful place. All right.
Can't go in the
Next
water
question.
though.
It is a little chilly. It is a little chilly. All right. Have you been to more countries or states?
Yeah, so this was an interesting one. I had to do some work on this. I've been to more states than countries. 41 states and like 30 countries.
That's pretty
So
good.
states win.
For now, you're still
For
young.
now.
All right.
Yeah.
What is your favorite color of hydrogen?
Economic hydrogen.
Oh, so you don't like hydrogen. Got it. Okay. Next question. Now this is the most important question. What is the best sandwich?
Yeah, so I got very interested in this question when you sent it because I'm a big sandwich freak, and particularly, New York sandwiches. There's a place called Ali Doro, Alidoro, that we always try to get before coming back to Midland. And they have a sandwich that has a combination of good and bad, where you get turkey, but you also get the Italian meats with it, as well as some Parmigiano Reggiano and some balsamic. And that's, in my mind, the perfect sandwich. You got a little good, a little bad. Good bread, just unfortunately costs like $25 when you pick one up. But that's New
Yeah,
York prices for you.
I think pretty much anything costs $25 when you walk out the door here these days. So
I
what are you
do
gonna
have the
do?
most. I do have the most Jersey Mike's points at Diamondback, though, I will tell you that. So I'm the leader in the clubhouse
That's
here in
amazing.
Midland.
All right, well then this man loves his sandwiches. All right,
Yes.
now, Case, thank you very much. Now that we know the real case, let's get down to business.
Great, great.
So, throughout our careers, we've watched the shale business grow and evolve to where we are today. And one of the big questions I get from both investors and operators is if I think the traditional energy sector will ever regain the kind of prominence it had in the SPX a decade ago. Lots of investors have been critical about how management teams have acted or communicated with them over time, and I think that's part of the reason it remains such a small part of the S&P. So, do you see a world where this changes in the future?
Yeah, I mean, listen, you get this question a lot, and I think the metric of percent of the S&P is such an arbitrary metric. I think it's going to be very hard for our sector to go back to 10% plus of the S&P. I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, this new business model of capital discipline, high return free cash back to shareholders seems to be working, and shareholders seem to be taking to it. You know, I think it's going to be company specific. Very clearly, the industry had kind of a messaging transparency problem at the early days of shale. You know, we all got caught up in the excitement of what was happening, and now, you know, cooler heads prevail. There's been a lot of consolidation. I think it's all been, you know, most of the consolidation has been received very, very well. And now you have, you know, a stronger sector. It might not be a bigger sector, but it's a stronger sector. And, you know, people always ask me this question, like, well, when are we going to get to this percent or this percent? And the answer may be never, but your stock price can go up by reducing your capital base. And that is probably what the path to, you know, stock price performance, continued stock price outperformance from the sector is going to, it's going to happen, right? It just might not be the expansion that we all hope for, but instead it's a shrinking capital base in more, you know, well-funded hands that, you know, acts responsibly and listens to shareholders.
Yeah, I mean, so the answer is that it doesn't matter if it gets to be a bigger part of the S&P because the operators are acting responsibly, delivering returns to stakeholders. So
yeah, I mean, listen, I think obviously flows matter and you know, the passive money matters, but at the end of the day, I think it's hard. I don't think we should predicate our business on trying to become double weighted in the S&P versus where we are today. We should run a business that, you know, returns capital to shareholders, exerts capital discipline, acts responsibly, and recognizes that the shareholders own the company, and I don't own the company.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. All right. Well, you mentioned M&A and sort of how the industry's evolved over time, and so, you know, the next question I have for you is what does the North American oil and gas industry look like 5 to 10 years from now? Will there still be room for the wildcatter, or an effort to produce the most oil and gas most efficiently with the least environmental impact? Will this be a game where only the large can survive? And if so, should investors be learning how to understand offshore again, or should North American operators without a runway be looking abroad?
Yeah, that's a question that I think is being discussed in a lot of boardrooms around North American shale companies. You know, what does the next decade, two decades look like? You know, I think I go back to what is our core competency? And for Diamondback, that's, you know, acquire and exploit strategy, where we have grown our business through acquisition, executed on the properties, you know, cheaper than the last operator, obviously in an environmentally friendly way as well. And, you know, I think my number one rule is know what you don't know. You know, we're not white space explorers. I think if you saw Diamondback doing a lot of white space exploring, you'd probably have to ask us some pretty tough questions. I think we can explore within the Permian, which we are doing, right? The resource base here is pretty incredible and expanding on at a rapid pace. And, you know, I think size and scale has certainly been rewarded from a multiples and a investor perspective. And I don't see that changing, but I also don't see the wildcatter going away. It might not be a public company as a wildcatter, but, you know, the wildcatter has been important to this business for a very, very long time. And I think they're just going to do it with different forms of capital than the public capital, because, as you know, the public capital wants a kind of a better risk-adjusted return and wants to know what they're investing in. And you know, the true exploration plays, when they're hits, they're amazing, but they're, you know, there's a lot of risk in that business.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, as you were saying that, I started thinking about how, I mean, we're recovering less than 10% of the oil in place, right? Like through some of these
shale wells. Yeah, I'll take 10. I think we're at 10, but I mean, I don't
slightly,
know.
Maybe 10-ish percent. So, you know, I guess as we continue along the technology curve here, maybe we don't need to run off to foreign places.
Certainly Diamondback doesn't, right? I mean, that's just not what our MO is and what we, you know, investors own the company for. Do I think eventually we can, you know, take little steps to continue to improve recoveries and reduce cost to be competitive on the global cost curve for a longer period of time? Yes, I think we're set up to do that. But, you know, we're not white space explorers that are going to look international or expand our business outside the Permian, because we're just really, really good at the Permian.
Right. So that sort of leads to the next question. and you started to answer it, you know, what do you think the best way to create value for shareholders is? But that, you know, and as many of us know, Diamondback and it's your performance record, you know, and I'm not asking you to throw stones, but you can if you want to, but how do you remain the lowest cost operator after all these years? Like, what can't your peers figure out?
Well, goes back to the beginning question, which is how do you create value? I think you have to know who you are, right? We know top to bottom, we are an acquire and exploit strategy that is entirely focused on being the lowest cost operator in a commodity-based business. And if you ask a first-year engineer at Diamondback that, or if you ask Travis that, they're going to answer the question the same way, so that there's a culture that permeates through the organization where we are all aligned on the company strategy and operating philosophy. And, you know, I think we have recognized where we have a competitive advantage, and that is, you know, drilling wells primarily in the Midland Basin cheaper than everybody else. You know, a lot of attention gets placed on cash operating costs. I think those are important, but certainly not as important as being able to drill 300, 400, 500 wells $1 million or $2 million cheaper than your competition, right? And that, in this business, that means that you know, the more assets should flow to you as the low cost operator.
Now, is that because you're better at sourcing, because your teams drill wells faster, because your size, you have stronger relationships with the service providers? What is it that drives that $1 to $2 million delta from the average?
It's been ingrained in us for a very long time. I mean, even going back to the Energen merger in 2018, you know, we predicated that deal on drilling their wells $2 million a well cheaper. And really, it's you know, it's a lot of little things. I think it's very cultural. I think we have a culture that pushes decision making and you know, the amount of G&A that we spend closer to the wellbore. So there's a very small corporate function here, right? Everybody's instead focused on how do I drill wells cheaper. If an idea is presented, it's and it doesn't work, as long as that employee made the right risk-adjusted decision, we will support it. And I think, you know, a lot of bigger companies have a very insular, do-no-harm type culture where, you know, they rely on outside contractors or outside advice to make decisions. And that's the opposite here. We try to take all those decisions in-house. You know, we control every part of the process on a drilling site, on a frac site, and we push the limits on new things. If something works, we are going to implement it very, very quickly. Now, the challenge for us is, you know, we're a lot bigger company now, and certainly after the Endeavor merger closes, than we used to be. So maintaining that chip on our shoulder type culture is going to be a key to our future success.
No, that makes sense. And so, okay, so it's a culture of, you know, controlling your own destiny, making the decisions in-house, keeping costs low, and also
risk-adjusted decisions, right?
Risk-adjusted decisions.
I think we support good risk-adusted decisions. And we also look across the fence line a lot, right? If someone's doing something better than us, we will check our egos at the door and do it. If you can prove to us that it reduces our cost structure or produces better wells, well, we will take that phone call and make that decision. I mean, QEP was a very small company when we acquired them, but they were doing some things on the drilling side that was better than what we were doing at the time. And we put that in place across our entire program, you know, within 6 months of that deal closing. And that was the Clear Fluids drilling.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you take all that culture together and then you add in, you know, a history of M&A and doing deals, with culminating here with the announcement of Endeavor. Tell us a little bit about the deal. What does
pretty,
that do
pretty
for
big
your
long
term? It's kind of big. You got the bond deal done yesterday, which was exciting. But what does that do for your long term prospects? How should we think about, like, this deal? How should we think about further consolidation going forward? Maybe answer that later. But yeah, tell us about the thought process here.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think this deal puts two very strong companies together, both based in Midland, you know, sets us up very, very well for the long term with respect to, you know, duration and quality of inventory. You know, there's a lot of natural synergies with offsetting acreage. I think there'll be a lot more long-term synergies with respect to infrastructure, electricity needs, you know, secondary zones, drilling, you know, 3-4 mile laterals, and who knows where we'll be, you know, in 10 years on drilling times and drilling costs. And I think the good thing is with this combination, we don't have to spend the riskier capital, so to speak, to continue to expand our resource base. Like, we have such a big combined resource base that we can execute on our plan, but also look at what's going on across the fence line, because I think there's going to be a lot of exploration, so to speak, in the basin over the next, you know, over the next decade. And we're going to have the acreage footprint to execute on that if it proves out that it works. But we don't have to be the first one to jump in and spend that riskier capital. We can be a fast follower.
Yeah, you mentioned a couple of things there that are key to, you know, development right now. The quality of the inventory, right? Endeavor had so many DSUs that haven't been touched yet, right? And when we think about when we think about inventory, right? And we kind of rank everyone in that way. It's a static number, right? And so when folks go drill wells, if they only drill it in one zone, that actually changes the value of that inventory. But when you have something that's untouched, right, you're able to go and fully develop that in a methodical way. Inventory.
Yeah, we all look at individual sticks, right? We rank them from highest PV to lowest. But really, the way to be thinking about that is really, what does the full project look like versus your other projects? Because if you, in the Midland Basin, if you leave a zone behind, you know, you're unlikely to go back and get that zone if it's in kind of the core development areas today. And so you really need to look at, like, on a project level basis, what is that half section, what does that full section look like on a rate of return or NPV basis versus what else is out there? You know, very clearly we could all drill individual sticks and, you know, have great recoveries and great numbers, but then the rest of the development would look a little suspect.
Yeah, we're seeing that a little bit out there. I know we didn't talk about this before, but you mentioned electricity. Obviously, that's something that's been on everybody's minds for a lot of reasons. We don't have to talk about data centers today. Maybe in a future episode.
It's amazing how many people are talking about that now.
It's everybody's first question. Hopefully it's a tailwind for the natural gas industry, but we'll see. I seem to remember Dimebag mentioning some kind of deal with a nuclear power provider or agreement. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. It seemed to be getting a lot of airtime. We signed a non-binding LOI with Oklo, who provides, you know, micro reactors to power, you know, various needs. I think for us, it would be used in one of our fields, you know, the benefit of a contiguous acreage position, you know, running on a power source that's 99.999% reliable, I think is a good thing. You know, they still have some hoops to get through on their side, but, you know, I think it kind of sends a message that we are willing to look at any option to improve our power supply, solidify our power supply, as well as, you know, improve runtime in the basin. You know, we have, you know, all of our fields on electric power, but a lot of times the utilities are not there. And so we're having to run that on an inefficient method of power generation. And so this, you know, Oklo deal, I think it's exciting. I think what the Net Power guys are doing is exciting. I think it's all of the above. I mean, I'm willing to try anything to, one, put some pressure on Texas to get their grid stability up, and two, you know, increase our runtime in the field. You know, that's a pretty good combo, you know, not to mention, you know, if we did run a field off of nuclear power, you'd be at zero scope 2 emissions for that field. I think that's pretty unique. So I don't think it's going to be running frac spreads and drilling rigs, but can it run a field, which, you know, as we, the only thing that did not go down during COVID was our power use. And if we keep production flat for the next 10 years, I've said this to a few people, if we keep production flat for the next 10 years, our power needs double. So there's a lot of power, and that's not a Diamondback issue. That's an industry issue. So we need a lot of power in the Permian, and we're willing to explore all forms of that, you know, as you can see by this Oklo agreement.
And what's the timing on that?
You know, we signed the LOI. You know, they got to do some work on their side. And, you know, I would hope in a couple of years we're making a real decision.
Got it. So it's we'd love to see that. Doesn't seem like it's an immediate, right? Like it's more towards the end of the decade then, right? Like,
right. Yeah. I mean, it's not immediate. I mean, and there, you know, it could be expanded. It could be just one, you know, one instance. I think you have to have contiguous acreage to be able to do it. And I think, the blocky nature of our position puts us in a really good spot.
I agree. All right. What's next here? I'm getting a couple of questions from the audience too, and I might actually throw one in there. You talked about learning from best practices of QEP and other folks. What are you expecting to learn from Endeavor?
Listen, Endeavor's a great operator. There's a lot of things that they do that we're pretty excited about. I think some of the methods they have in terms of infrastructure development, they have a supply store, pipes, valves, and fittings that supplies all of their needs. I think we could save tens of millions of dollars a year by not having to go pay third parties for supplies like that. They're probably a little more vertically integrated. They've got like 80 electricians on staff, which I think is a very valuable employee in the basin.
Anywhere, by the way.
Like, right, anywhere.
You try to get an electrician to your house lately? I know.
Yeah, so they're doing a lot of great things above ground. Below ground, I think we're pretty excited to see what they are doing from a reservoir modeling perspective, a little different than us. I think we have very similar operating philosophies in terms of zones to develop and spacing. We probably have a different approach to our D&C operations. We're taking a little more risk on the drilling side, as well as doing the simul-frac on the completion side. But I'm excited. I mean, we didn't guide to any synergies coming over from their side, and I know that they're going to be there.
Yeah, we'll look.
There's a lot of smart people over there.
Yeah, we know for sure. Okay, so now I'd be remiss if I did not ask about everyone's favorite topic, not data centers, but Gen AI, which obviously we need data centers for. So first, is this technology something that you're implementing at Diamondback in any of your processes today? And if so, how?
We're not implementing it exactly today. I think AI and machine learning get tossed about in energy interchangeably. We have a lot of machine learning, a lot of work being done on that side. I do think, if our data gets cleaned up at some point, there will be a great use case for Gen AI across our portfolio.
Just gotta stop you right there. I know someone who's cleaned up a lot of data. Case and it's a company. I think it's called Enveris. I don't know. Anyway, we can get you an intro if you need.
You're hired. But listen. We're collecting so much data in the field. We don't know what to do with it. And I think there's going to be a use case for it. I don't know if it's going to be the miracle that gets us from 10% recoveries to 15, but could it get you from 10 to 10 and a half, and then little wins here and there, and reduce the cost structure. And spend less money in the field. Yeah, I think there's a lot of use cases for GAI in our business. I just think it's still in its infancy.
I think that's right too. And you sort of answered the second question: how do you see the rise of the tech impacting your business? And yeah, it's helping you on the margin to begin with, whether it's on recoveries or costs or whatnot. We see the same thing. That's how we're approaching it too, both from the the research side where I sit, and then the platform side too, taking all that data and
it's gonna be a lot of little wins, right? A lot of little wins that get you there. And do you get to TD in 7.3 days versus 7.5? Do you need to set intermediate casing at the same point for every single well on a 20 well pad? I think we need to have the culture and the flexibility to be able to not make our operations cookie cutter, and I think we've done that. Where we, change development styles in different areas, different zones, different completion sizes by zone, by area. And that I think is going to be all the little wins that come our way.
It's sort of sitting in the middle of this right now, being in Enveris and you saw our announcement with AWS and who we spoke with last month. Seeing big tech and big bad energy coming together is interesting, and I'm curious if you see like tech's drive for more energy either driving the industry or driving partnerships with the industry. Like, how do you foresee Microsoft, Google, Amazon, engaging with the traditional energy sector?
Yeah, maybe not as much on the oil side, but certainly on the gas side. I think the worst kept secret for people that understand energy is that these tech companies are massive consumers of energy, and they need reliable energy, right? I mean, a data center needs, and this is someone told me this, but a data center needs 5 nines of uptime, 99.99% uptime. Well, you're not going to get that from windmills and solar panels. So, you know, I think they have to find a way to look at other forms of energy, whether it's nuclear, whether it's natural gas, to, you know, to improve their business and improve their uptime. And in my mind, that makes the U.S. barrel, you know, more of a bulletproof barrel that we can export around the world and use geopolitical, you know, our geopolitical power from the production of barrels in the Permian Basin.
No, that makes sense. I feel like 2 years ago, you talk about like the traditional energy sector and nobody wanted to talk about it. And now it's like, well, how can we leverage our homegrown resource to drive our tech platforms forward?
So, yeah. Well,
it's an evolving
math story. Math and physics seem to be undefeated. So I think, you know, if you look at the need that our business provides, we're such a beaten down industry publicly. I mean, I have a lot of theories about that, about why, but you know, I think people are coming to terms with the fact that we're going to be around for a very long time.
Yeah, it does seem that way. CERAWeek taught us that, I think, a couple weeks back. All right, so I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't have one environmental question for you.
All right.
So no matter what old man's in the White House next year, the methane fee, Quad O, Subpart W, all these new regulations intended to incentivize operators to clean up their business, they're still going to be there. And in my sense is this is going to have a smaller impact on large organizations rather than smaller ones from a cost perspective.
For sure.
But I'd love your take. How do you see these changes from the environmental standpoint impacting your business, but then maybe impacting, you know, your peers as well?
Yeah, I mean, I would rather see a practical approach to putting these regulations in place. I think our shareholders have held us to higher standards than the EPA or the government for a very long time now. So I'm confident the larger operators are going to do well in this environment. I think some of the things that are a little ridiculous are the fact that anybody can take a FLIR camera that doesn't even know what a flare looks like and point it at a location and claim that we have an unlit flare, and they have no idea what they're talking about. So, you know, I think the unfortunate part of the regulations is kind of things like that that are going to release NGOs to try to make our lives a living hell when, in fact, we're trying to clean our business up, right? I mean, I think that's my biggest problem with the fight between regulators and oil and gas companies is that the large oil and gas companies are doing an actually pretty good job at cleaning our business up. I mean, point that satellite over Russia or Kazakhstan and you tell me what their venting looks like from a methane perspective. So
I'm not sure the Russian hackers are going to let you do that. The Russian hackers are going to be like, no, just keep looking at America or something.
Well, I'll go point it over that the gates of hell in Turkmenistan that's been on fire for 40 years.
Minor detail.
It's minor detail. Well, but listen, we're cleaning our business up. I would like to kind of think of a Diamondback barrel being that bulletproof barrel from a cost perspective, environmental perspective, and a geopolitical regulatory perspective.
Yeah, I see that. I mean, I feel like the bigger risk is so it sounds like, and I think I agree with this, the larger operators, they're doing what's being asked of them, but in the end they're going to get dinged a little bit here and there for some uncontrollable, you know, reasons, because that's what happens in the field. It's the smaller operators that are going to have challenges with the costs associated with some of these legacy wells, these older, you know, conventional.
I think so. But the larger operators have had to spend what I would call less economic capital cleaning up all the old vertical batteries, all the old vertical wells that were run off gas pneumatics. I mean, not, you know, there's a return on that, but it's very, very minimal. And, you know, I call that kind of the less economic capital that we've spent. I think we're spending $30 million on it this year. As an acquire and exploit company, it's natural that, you know, you're going to have to do that for every deal that you do. But, you know, we have the balance sheet to be able to do it and a shareholder base that supports doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the bigger the risk is like the reputational risk, because these satellites go up, not just with the guns that you're talking about, but like, you know, methane sat and the inability of folks to discern what's actually what. And so,
yeah, and I don't think the industry gets the benefit of the doubt, which is the problem.
Why would you do that? Do you deserve
that?
I'm
not
sure. Your
tech buddies get the benefit of the doubt. They don't get the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, they're cool. They wear sweatshirts to work. Yeah. All right. All right. We're running out of time here. But you know, there are just a couple other like quick little questions that I think a lot of folks are interested in. Midstream in the basin in the Midland Basin seems to be a challenge, maybe more on the gas side than the oil side. How do you feel that that's going to evolve over time, especially as the GOR changes, you know, as the wells get older?
Yeah, I think there's pockets of tightness. You're going to have to continue to build processing capacity, even if oil production flatlines in the basin. I do think, you know, the midstream operators are doing a better job than they used to. It used to be show me the gas and I'll build the plant. At least they're kind of building ahead of the curve or the ramp here. Now, a lot of time these plants are filling up very, very quickly.
I think they're just being nice to the midstream operators right now. I'm not sure I see the same thing, but that's okay.
I decided to be nice to them today. I'm not going to mention that 90% of our flaring is due to midstream issues, but that's another topic.
Don't mention that.
but you know, listen, there's a lot of gas coming out of pockets of these basins, and particularly New Mexico state line on the Delaware side, and you know, the northern Midland on our side. And it's on us as an operator too to continue to provide accurate forecasts, continue to, you know, commit to downstream pipes to build more takeaway. I mean, I think we're hopefully going to get another, you know, long haul gas pipe announced here pretty soon because we need it, right? I mean, we need to get the gas out of the basin.
No, that makes sense. All right. We are at time now. Case, thank you so much for joining me today. This was fantastic. Really enjoyed having you on. I like that you shared your map behind us. So now we know all your secrets.
And my Kobe photo.
And well, your Kobe photo is fantastic. Just for your roots, you know, your Southern California roots. It's good.
Mama mentality.
all right. So to everyone else, join me next time when Morning Energy Live will actually be live in Houston. At our conference Evolve, May 7th to the 9th. I think there should be a link somewhere in this platform for you to go register. So, Case, thanks again, and we'll see everyone else next time. Take care.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.